What could you do if your data was working for you and not against you? With Bloomberg delivering enterprise data directly to your systems, you get easy access to the details you want, optimized for higher level analysis, and financial data experts committed to helping you maximize your every move. Our data is made for more, so you can show the world what you're made of. Visit Bloomberg.com/enterprise data to learn more.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
One of the stocks in the news here, we're right in the thick of earnings, is Facebook. The kids call it Meta. It's down about 10% today. They put out some numbers last night after the close. Revenue a little bit slower than expected. And then they're ramping up spending on artificial intelligence, and that's setting the stock back a little bit here. Let's get some perspective on Facebook, and nobody better than David Kirkpatrick. He is the founder of Techomini, and he's also the author of The Facebook Effect. In my mind, the definitive book on Facebook when it just kind of burst onto the public consciousness. David, thanks so much for joining us here. What were your takeaways from, I guess, their results, the conference call last night, Mark Zuckerberg's comments about the investments required for AI? How do you put it all together?
Well, first of all, their results were stellar. You can't say anything other than that. They are making great growth and profit. The problem, such as there is a problem, is that they are spending so much money on capital costs, mostly connected to artificial intelligence. And the question of what the returns on that will be, I think, is legitimately on investors' minds. And that probably more than any other factor explains the fairly dramatic drop in the stock.
How about for you, though, David? I mean, are you questioning, just how good of an investment this might be? Or you think this is perhaps like a, you know, it will be a significant revenue driver at some point?
It's a great question. Well, first of all, you got to look at this company of all the tech companies has just skyrocketed in the last year or so. So, you know, this is a very highly valued stock compared to what it was. And I think given the extraordinary run-up, a little bit of a correction is hardly a shock. So probably you could say it's not at all problematic that the stock has pulled back a little bit from that perspective. I think the most interesting thing, I'm actually here at the Council on Foreign Relations, having just attended a meeting that was very heavily focused on energy. And, you know, even Zuckerberg in his remarks yesterday was talking about the energy costs of AI are going to be one of the significant capital expenditures they're having to deal with. So they have to build their own renewable energy infrastructure in many instances these days. And this is true of all these big companies. The thing that I'm thinking about right now is whether, in some sense, because of the sheer scale of the investments that are having to be made in data centers and the energy associated with them, that these companies are shifting to, in the long run, a fundamentally different business model that's a little bit more like a utility, where they're just going to be facing these ongoing gigantic costs just to stay abreast with one another. I don't think we know the answer to that yet, but it could very well be starting to happen.
I got to say that when we're looking at the estimates for the CapEx here, to me, it doesn't look like it's all that different from what they had previously estimated. So they now think CapEx, its capital expenditure, is going to be in the range of $35 to $40 billion before $30 to $37. I don't know. That sounds pretty similar to me, is it not?
It is similar. And, you know, I think, you know, markets tend to overreact. There's no question. I mean, I think what people were reacting to in Zuckerberg's call yesterday was more a tone that he was conveying that the payoff for some of these expenditures may be a little longer than people expected. They don't face any fundamental problem in the short term. So in that sense, you're right. And in fact, I think Meta has done an unusually good job of taking advantage of AI in the recent year or two, in that they are doing a better job targeting advertising with AI. That's a concrete benefit. The thing that's also interesting, though, to me, if I were an investor, that I would be somewhat concerned about is that the Meta AI product, which they're just rolling out to their customers or their users across a lot of their services, effectively is a way of declaring that they're competing head to head with Google, because they're basically starting to do what is effectively search inside Instagram, inside Facebook, using their Meta AI product. So you've got to, that's a different business model if they go down that road too far. They still have an extraordinary ability to target advertising that is superior to pretty much anybody else, and that's going to guarantee a lot of profit for the long term.
David, where is the metaverse these days in terms of Mr. Zuckerberg's zeitgeist?
Well, in his zeitgeist, it's very prominent. I don't think it's really high in the zeitgeist of much of anybody else. I mean, it's so prominent, he renamed his company. I wouldn't be surprised if he regrets that now. But he got out of a tight spot with Francis Haugen at the moment by doing that. I don't think the metaverse is nearly such a big deal as you would think listening to him. And I don't think any other company thinks it's that big of a deal in the any kind of short term. The degree to which it could be a big deal long term is unknown. We know that AI is changing everything now. We have no reason to think that metaverse issues are going to change everything anytime soon.
Not that I would think that Zuckerberg would have commented on this, but I'm sure he's got to be thinking, you know, what if TikTok gets banned, and potentially what a boon that would be for Instagram and the Reels product. I mean, how much do you think is that getting priced into the stock right now?
Probably not at all. There's also things that aren't being priced in, like extreme regulatory pushback in Europe that's really changing the way that Meta is able to target users in advertising across all of its product lines. So there's big shifts happening. It's very hard to know where these companies are headed. But yes, if TikTok really were banned, which frankly I do not expect, that would be fantastically great news for this company. And one would want to, you know, go long on them if you thought that's really likely. So yeah, there's so many shifting parts in this equation. It's astonishing.
All right, David, it's a busy, busy week for tech earnings. Also Microsoft and Alphabet. Let's just go to Alphabet, because that's kind of dovetails on kind of the digital advertising theme that we started last night with Facebook. How are our good friends at Google/Alphabet, how are they doing? What do you expect here with their earnings?
Well, I think again, earnings from the standpoint of the ongoing business will be good. The question again will arise, how much are they spending on AI and data center infrastructure, and what's the chronology of the likely payoff? And you're seeing concerns being raised by analysts that the number of investment is going to be higher and the possible long-term returns, just like with Meta, could be longer. But look, these businesses are thriving on, for the most part, overall. I think Microsoft in particular, which is also coming up, is a company that just can't really do anything wrong from the standpoint of investors. And I think they too are going to be spending even more on AI infrastructure. And it's becoming almost like an energy investment as well as a data center and server investment.
So then it sounds like, though, there has to be, an investor's mind at least, there is a ceiling for how much investment in AI is too much. It sounds like that there is a bit of a threshold and a fine line here.
Let's figure out what the ceiling is. I have no clue. Nobody really knows what's happening with AI. It's a frenzy. Everybody's piling in, rightly so, but the exact terms of long-term competition are effectively unknown. So to say the ceiling is X or the ceiling is Y, it's pretty hard to do.
All right, David. So stepping back here, who do you think among how real is AI to you? I mean, I think that a lot of people are trying to get a sense of, is this just big data we were talking about 4 or 5 years ago, or is this something fundamentally different?
Well, it is something fundamentally different. I think that's widely believed at this point, and I believe it. But again, the way it's going to manifest itself in business terms is extremely hard to predict. I know for myself, I am surprisingly often using ChatGPT instead of Google, and I'm getting results that I really can use. And I think many people are finding that. So this is changing the nature of these businesses in a fundamental way. And I think if Meta, for example, successfully deploys Meta AI across all its products, and just while you're in the middle of using Instagram or Facebook, you can do a search using their AI tool that you would have otherwise had to leave Meta's product to go to Google to do, that's a strategic benefit for them. So it is worth making those investments. But you know, when you're talking about annual capital expenditures of $40 billion, you know, it's hard to know what's, is it, should it be 45? Should it be 35? Look, I wish I knew.
David, thanks so much for joining us. As always, always appreciate getting your perspective on all things tech. David Kirkpatrick, founder of Techomini, and also the author of the book, the seminal book, I think, on Facebook, is The Facebook Effect there.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Big economic data point coming out today. GDP plus some inflation data coming out. Spooking the markets a little bit here. I'm looking at the yield curve. The two-year Treasury sitting right at 5%. Big move, up 7 basis points. And that kind of feeds into, like, I'm looking at the 30-year fixed mortgage. It's now back up to 7.24%.
Better believe it's going to be higher next week. Yeah. Assuming, you know, that the trend right now still holds. And I'm sure, you know, Powell next week probably going to have to rip up the script, say something a bit more hawkish.
Yep.
We're going to have Ira Jersey come in and tell us all about it now. So Ira Jersey joining us on Zoom from Princeton, New Jersey, where we definitely need to host our next show from.
Yes.
We will do that
they
at some
good-
point. So Ira is our chief U.S. interest rate strategist at Bloomberg Intelligence. Thanks for joining us, Ira. We've been looking at these GDP numbers, and obviously the inflation print really seems to be driving the market action today. Tell us what you're looking at.
Yeah, so obviously that inflation print just implies that the monthly number that we get tomorrow is going to be much higher than economists are expecting, and that is a big driver. You know, when inflation's this high, that the market has to continue to reprice the expectations of when and if the Federal Reserve is going to actually cut interest rates. And the market now is much more symmetric in thinking not only, yes, it's a, like 50% chance that they're going to cut interest rates, but there's actually a growing chance that's being priced into markets that the Fed's next move may actually be an interest rate increase, right, a hike at some point. I personally think that that's a relatively low probability still, probably lower than what the market's pricing. But on hold is, I think, a growing default scenario for the next 9 to 12 months for the Fed because inflation's just too high. It's way above their comfort level.
So, you know, Ira, I guess one of the questions is here, did the Fed and Jay Powell back in December, when they kind of had that Fed pivot, started talking a little bit more dovish, in hindsight, was that a mistake?
Well, it was a mistake because their forecasts were wrong, right? Like at the end of the day, the Fed makes forecasts just like everyone makes forecasts, and their forecast for how quickly inflation was going to slow down was incorrect. And you know, we were incorrect too, and we were among the more hawkish or less dovish, probably strategists on the street. You know, the issue that's come up is that when you looked at the survey data, a lot of the survey data back in December and even in January and February, it was pointing toward a slowdown in the economy. So a lot of the traditional indicators for economic activity, like ISM New Orders, like some of the consumer confidence surveys, they were all pointing to a potential slowdown. But and even though those have rebounded just a little bit, the hard data, so things like retail sales, personal consumption, spending, the jobs data obviously is probably among the most important and visible of these numbers, those have all been reasonably robust. So there's this disconnect between what people are saying and what people are doing. And I think that that's really been a challenge for forecasters who rely on these surveys for forward-looking indicators, and they just haven't been realized. So you know, so they made a bad forecast, so therefore they made a bad pivot, and now they have to kind of take some of that back, and that's exactly what you've heard out of a lot of the Fed speakers the last couple of weeks. They're in the quiet period now, so you're not going to hear anything from Fed speakers until next Wednesday. But when you go back and you listen to what Jay Powell said and a lot of the other speakers, you know, they're going to probably continue to say, like, look, unless inflation goes down more significantly and substantially, we're going to keep interest rates on hold. And I think that that's probably what Jay Powell will say next week.
So it sounds like you think then, Ira, that this, you know, print that we got today, the robust inflation prints that we've gotten to start this year, who knows what we'll see tomorrow, doesn't seem to really change the narrative a whole lot, that the economy is still proving you know, to run really strong. Doesn't seem like interest rates are really denting that a whole lot. And that's still the narrative that they're going to go with? Or do you think that anything has changed here?
Yeah, I don't think very much has changed. You know, interest rate sensitive sectors have certainly been affected by interest rate hikes. But the but what's happened over the last 15, 20 years is that we've shifted away, firstly, from interest rate sensitive growth to non-interest rate sensitive growth. So things like the services sector, when you dig into the details of today's GDP report, you see that on a seasonally adjusted annualized basis, the retail the services sector saw 4% growth, whereas the durable goods sector saw a negative 1% growth, right? So and durable goods were things like autos, right? So auto sales have slowed down substantially. Part of that's on price, you know, certainly prices have gone up, but that's also credit availability, right? Large purchases like automobiles and houses, you tend to be purchased on credit of some form or another. And so those are very sensitive to these higher interest rates, whereas the service sector just isn't. Services aren't services spending have more to do with wages, how much disposable cash you have, as opposed to, you know, you're not going to probably go out and go to the movies and then, you know, finance that over 10 years, right? That's just not something you're going to do. But if you have, you know, if you get a pay raise, you might go to that an extra movie every month. And that's basically what you're seeing in the data. And if those trends continue, then you can wind up having an okay economy. And the Federal Reserve, you know, might not have to move interest rates very much at all.
Well, then what can they do about inflation then if our economy is just structurally more resistant to higher interest rates?
Yeah, well, there's not much you could do. You could either raise interest rates a lot more, and that would probably ultimately be recessionary because you'd wind up with a recession in housing, a recession maybe in the auto sector and some of the other interest rate sensitive sectors, and that could start ultimately to bring down the entire economy. Or you could do things that are politically unpopular, things like raising taxes, for example, just reduce the ability for the household sector to spend money. And this is something that I think a mistake that the Federal Reserve made, the Federal Reserve could come out and just say, like, hey, we're not worried about 2.5-3% inflation anymore. That's fine. And if you go back to the 1990s, for example, like we were running at around 2.5-3% PCE deflator. So, you know, why not pivot back to that? You know, I think the mistake that the Fed made was having a hard target of 2% on inflation as opposed to something just a little bit more flexible. And the fact is inflation's not increasing, right? Inflation's not going up anymore. It's just not coming down. And because it's not coming down, they're not reaching their 2% target. And I think that's where the disconnect really has come.
All right, Ira, thank you so much for joining us. Ira Jersey, Chief U.S. interest rate strategist, Bloomberg Intelligence, joining us from our Princeton campus down via Zoom there. So be interesting to see. So the GDP print, again, the takeaway, as I understand from you, Molly, the headline, very disappointing, but if you dig underneath it, a little bit less so.
Yeah, exactly. I think, you know, one of the parts of the headline that was disappointing was the fact that trade subtracted from growth, as in higher imports relative to exports, but higher imports also mean that there's a lot of demand. The idea is just that we're sourcing it from outside the country rather than producing it here. So I think that still bodes well for the story of the consumer and the health of the consumer, and that demand in the economy is still strong. And obviously that's still making inflation not go away.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
Molly Smith, she's sitting in for Alex Steele this week. I'm Paul Sweeney. We're live here in our Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. We're streaming live on YouTube, so you can head over to youtube.com and search Bloomberg Podcast, and that's where you will find us. We had that GDP print that came out this morning, significantly weaker on the surface than the forecast, and showing a pretty market decline from last month as well. And that's kind of having an impact on the markets, as John Tucker was just reporting. Yields up, stock prices down. Let's get some perspective here. We can do that with Barry Ritholtz. He's host of Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. He's also the founder of Ritholtz Wealth Management. Hey, Barry, so we get the economic data. It kind of freaks people out as it relates to where this economy is going. A, what did you read into the economic data that came out today, both on GDP and inflation, and maybe how the market's reacting to it?
Yeah, so I always love the attempt to impose rationality on what is essentially a free-for-all. We've had the Fed crank up rates 525 basis points from zero, and we continue to hear the phrase long and variable lags on the growth side. And at a certain point, you have to assume the chickens come home to roost. And this is the natural impact of higher cost of credit, higher rates. We've already seen housing slow because there's no real supply around. But now you're seeing it impact things like automobile sales. Remember, went through a big period where you couldn't get cars easily. Now that's behind us, and car sales are starting to slow down. Gasoline sales are starting to slow down. You have to lay this right at the feet of the Fed. And yet at the same time, when we take apart the inflation data, you know, the Fed BLS data includes renewals as well as someone moving into a new house or apartment. If your lease renews, if you just renew your lease, that was set in motion 2 years ago when you did your prior lease. The Fed has nothing whatsoever to do with, rates have nothing to do with it. But 2 years ago, that lease had a heavy, high number built into it. Back that out, and you're at the 2% inflation target for the Fed.
I think there's got to be more to it, though, than housing right now, though. No, Barry? I mean, it sounds like there's so many other broader services costs right now that are so expensive. I mean, one of them that was in the GDP report was financial services and insurance. I mean, we talk a lot about in this show, especially homeowners insurance, car insurance. I mean, those are things you can't really avoid.
That's right. But you have to look at what's driving those prices higher. Is it monetary policy? Is it, you know, pent up demand? Look at what's been going on in Florida with both homeowners and automobiles. It's very difficult to get insurance, and you have to turn around and say you have all these cars that have gotten flooded out from repeated hurricanes and repeated flooding events. You have all these homeowners who live right on the water. These are prices going up, but you have an externality driving it. It's not inflation. It's global warming and climate change. And just maybe Florida is a crazy example because, you know, Florida is Florida. But when we look around and look at the things that are going higher, like healthcare and the cost of education, that's been in the backdrop for 25 years and has been the most expensive side of the services thing. Insurance is a very specific reaction to an externality and not what we think of. Hey, if the Fed raises rates to 10%, are they going to make the cost of waterfront homeowners insurance any cheaper in Florida? Or when you have all these cars flooded out or being destroyed in places by weather, the Fed has zero impact on that. You have to put that into a different context than usual inflation.
So, Barry, with today's pullback, you know, we got the S&P off about, you know, 5% from its highs. That feels like it's just a healthy kind of pullback in what may be an otherwise upwardly trajecting market. Is that how you view it, or is there anything else going on here?
You read my mind, Paul. Look, we finished the first quarter with the NASDAQ 100 up 8.5% and the S&P 500 up 10.2%. That's a good year. Forget quarter. That's on average, 8 to 10% is what you should rationally expect from equity markets. So a little bit of a pullback is healthy. Let me also point out Even though we have very strong earnings and revenue numbers, a lot of it was built into the expectations, and they're a little disappointing compared to Q4. So, look, what are we, about a quarter of the way through? About 140 companies have reported, plus 4.5% on profits, and plus about, I'm ballparking this because as the numbers come out, the shifts, but plus 3.5% on revenues. Go back to Q4, and as good as these numbers sound, it was plus 6.8% on earnings and plus nearly 4% on revenues. As it almost makes Q1 look a little disappointing. I also suspect a lot of these strong numbers have been built into expectations. And so it's never the actual numbers, but how the market reacts to those numbers that are so revealing.
Well, market reaction today has been rough. And we've got now like the traders' bets for the timing of the first Fed cut fully priced for the first meeting now out to December. I mean, remember, not too long ago, people thought that first cut was going to be coming last month. So tell us a little bit about the environment for rate cuts here. And I mean, also that possibility if we don't get one at all in 2024.
Right. This is a little bit one part analysis, one part wishful thinking. From reading everything Jerome Powell has been saying and talking about, and just looking at the arc of the data that's been coming in, I suspect the Fed very much recognizes that the economy is beginning to slow, not dramatically, but a little bit. And they're now at the point where they're looking for an excuse to take rates down marginally. More than half of people, so about half of the homes out, single family homes, don't have mortgages. But of those that do, half are 4% or less, and something like 65% are at 5% or less. So these people have golden handcuff with their mortgages. That's why there's no supply or such limited supply of homes out there. And that's the biggest single component in the inflation numbers. I suspect Jay Powell understands that. The sort of paradox we've been living with is that if the Fed lowers rates, which will ultimately bring mortgage rates down, you'll see a whole lot more supply hit the market. And that could have an impact, especially in the rental market, of driving that aspect of either PCE or CPI inflation lower. Seems kind of counterintuitive for lower inflation, reduce FOMC rates. But that's the odd situation we find ourselves in after underbuilding single family homes for a decade post GFC.
Hey, Barry, you know, Molly was just, you know, referencing the WERP function, how the market was discounting maybe six rate cuts, cuts in the beginning of the year. And here we are now down to like one. Is that unusual for the market to get it so wrong or change its bets in such a short period of time? Does that typically happen?
Well, one of my all time favorite authors is William Goldman, who wrote Marathon Man and The Princess Bride. And he won Academy Awards for the screenplay for Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. He used to very famously say, nobody knows anything. And that when you're looking out forward, look at the track record of economists, of the Fed themselves, and of people who are forecasting, including the market, when rate cuts are going to happen, where rates are going to go. It's been so consistently wrong for so long. I mean, look at the dot plot is hilariously wrong. At a certain point, you have to ask yourself, why are we paying any attention to these forecasts? I know it's a necessary evil and it's all part of how we do our jobs. I think we have to dramatically lower the weight we put on these sorts of forecasts. You know, occasionally even a blind squirrel finds a nut. So sometimes somebody gets it right. But when you take the average, when you look at the overall consensus, not only were we expecting, was the market pricing in rate cuts last year, because they were pricing in a recession, but look how wrong they were on the round of increases, how quickly it came, how far it went. Of all the many things that the human genius can do, predicting things like Fed funds rate just ain't one of them.
Real quickly for you here, Barry. So next week, Fed's going to be presumably holding interest rates. We're not getting any new forecasts. 30 seconds, what should we look out for?
I mean, I want to see how we continue to do earnings wise. We're running a pretty reasonable beat rate, although obviously the better companies, the better earnings come out earlier. It's that, it's the components of inflation. And I want to keep an eye on consumer spending. That'll let us know if the Fed has kept us too tight for too long and it's really beginning to bite into the economy.
All right, Barry, thank you so much for joining us. As always, Barry Ritholtz, he is the host of Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. Highly recommend you check out that podcast. He gets phenomenal guests week after week after week and a lot of smart discussion about investing and about these markets. Oh, and he's got a day job. He's the founder of Ritholtz Wealth Management. So we appreciate getting a few minutes of his time.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
James Abate joins us. He's a managing director, chief investment officer at Center Asset Management, joining us from New York via Zoom. James, thanks so much for joining us here. What did you take away from the economic data we saw this morning and what it may mean for the Federal Reserve?
Well, when you look at today's release of annualized GDP of 1.6%, it was much lower than expectations, and it was combined with a higher inflation reading with the PCE coming in to 3.7%. Now, we may see, you know, some offset to that tomorrow with PPI numbers impacting the deflator, which is the Fed's preferred metric in terms of its 2% price target. But the bottom line is that when you look at equities and the fact that we see no safe harbor in the equity markets today, is that the margin of safety for markets and U.S. markets in particular is that the expectations have been that the Fed would be reducing rates at least two or three times through the end of the year. And we would see the economy move strongly ahead to support what we have in terms of double-digit earnings expectations for the S&P 500. So neither of the data points that came out today are consistent with either of those pillars that's been holding up the market since the rally began in October 2023.
Right. That's the PCE data coming out tomorrow that you were just referring to. So we'll get a look at the March inflation data there. But coming back to this GDP report today, I mean, when you're looking at the surface level of slower growth and higher inflation, it doesn't really sound like that soft landing story that we've all been betting on, huh?
Well, not everybody's been betting on that. I think, our view has been that when you look at the major economic indicators, there has been somewhat of a disconnect, meaning that the market was highly dependent upon both interest rates declining and earnings expectations, which were consistent with a booming economy. So if you just want to look at top-down indicators that would give some indications of economic activity, I mean, ISM indices or leading economic indicators, they remain in kind of flattish or, recessionary type levels. They seem to be bouncing or pivoting higher, but not yet to any type of booming economic recovery. So from that perspective, when you look at what's happening from an earnings perspective, you've got essentially flattish sales growth still. You've got profit margins across the S&P 500 stable, but with labor costs continuing to be pressure, potential for a degradation of profit margins. And when you look at what expectations are embedded in the S&P 500, it's essentially mid-single digits revenue growth with double-digit earnings growth. Now, how you get to that two times operating leverage when sales growth is relatively anemic outside of things that are tied towards AI and profit margins declining doesn't really reconcile with essentially the expectations that are embedded in earnings expectations, as well as some of the top-down indicators, as mentioned via the manufacturing statistics like the PMIs, as well as leading economic indicators.
I'll tell you where to make money
Chipotle Mexican Grill. The stock's up 4% today, all-time high. People are still buying their tacos and burritos.
It's because they're not letting the employees eat the chicken.
I know. That's exactly right.
That's
we talked about that earlier. So, James, how about in the fixed income space here? I can get 5% sitting in two-year treasuries. Is that a fair trade, or should I go out and maybe take some credit risk here?
No, I think if you look at premiums, and credit premiums or high-yield premiums in particular are consistent with the equity risk premium. And the equity risk premium is nothing more than the anticipated return of stocks versus the risk-free alternative, which is, as you mentioned, you know, yielding 5% right now. So, you know, our view at this point in terms of the market and why we've been very defensive, have re-implemented hedges in our American Select Equity Fund, is the fact that the way we calculate a forward equity risk premium, it's on at the level that we last witnessed in early 2000.
Oh, boy.
And I hate to say it, right before the crash of 1987.
Yep,
so both credit premiums and equity risk premiums leave no margin of safety, which is something that either leads to a flat equity market or potentially some type of major drawdown if there's the implementation or instigation of some type of catalyst.
Looking at the two-year yield coming up on 5% on the day, got to think if maybe, you know, you didn't cash in on it when it was 5.2 in October, maybe a little bit of a second chance here. Is this a good level?
Yeah, I think that's very important because the expectations are that, you know, the Fed, even if they do see continued economic weakness or maybe there is some type of financial event in regional banks or even the further escalation of some kind of geopolitical crisis, which would really be the only cover that the Fed would have to reduce interest rates. I would tell people that, you know, if you're relying upon a reduction in interest rates from these levels, be careful what you wish for, because when you look at market drawdowns over many periods of time, some of the most significant market drawdowns happen when the Fed is aggressively easing in response to a crisis. And our view going into the year was that the Fed was not going to reduce rates unless there was actually the introduction of a slower economic environment or a crisis. So to lock in, you know, 5.2% yield at this point in time, I think is, you know, a wise choice vis-a-vis other investment alternatives right now, particularly since the premium that you're being paid for owning equities as well as owning credit is, in essence, zero.
All right, James, thanks so much for joining us there. James Abate, Managing Director and Chief Investment Officer for Center Asset Management. Decidedly conservative outlook there, and that is being borne out today with the market down. I don't know. I guess you could look at today's data and say, all right, economy's slowing down. Maybe the Fed will, in fact, cut rates. They're not worried about an overheating economy, but you did have that inflation print that kind of
That really is just taking the entire story today. And, like, you know, as we've been saying, some of these underlying measures of growth underneath the GDP figure still pretty strong. So, and I'm sure the Fed will definitely be attuned to some of those as well.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way from design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/Green Festival.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
It is earnings season in full, fast and furious. They're coming. A good print coming out of a large pharma company, AstraZeneca, just early this morning. Moving that stock here. And we are fortunate right now to check in with Pascal Soriot. He is the CEO of AstraZeneca. He is in London joining us via Zoom. Patrick, thanks so much. Pascal, thanks so much for taking the time. We really appreciate getting a few minutes of your time. You guys reported numbers this morning. What are the key takeaways from your most recent quarter for your investors?
Hi, Paul. Thank you so much for having me. Yes, we had a tremendous start of the year. Actually, our sales, our revenue, I should say, grew by 19%. But the exciting piece was that every portfolio of products grew very strongly. Oncology plus 26% to $5 billion for the quarter. Cardiovascular 23%. Rare disease 16% growth. The geographies grew 19% in the U.S. and Europe. The most remarkable was 40% growth in the emerging markets outside of China, and China itself is returning to growth. So really a very, very strong start of the year. And beyond the financials, our portfolio, our pipeline is making tremendous progress. And we started new phase three trials, and we announced very positive results, in particular in oncology, which we will present at the ASCO in Chicago very soon.
Yeah, you've got an investor day coming up next month, and it seems like you just said, you're going to discuss the pipeline, including the timing of future treatments and their revenue potential. So can you give us a little sneak peek now for some of us who can't wait?
Yes, exactly. Actually, Marty, thank you for that question. What we're going to try and show to investors is that we can be a strong growth company, not only for the next 7, 8 years to 2030, but even beyond that. And so the growth over the next period of time to 2030 is going to be driven by what we have in our hands today and what is going to come out of our phase three pipeline very soon. So we're going to attract attention to investors of investors to the major growth drivers. We're going to show them where consensus is actually underestimating some of our products and the opportunities we have in our pipeline. We have a very large pipeline of new projects, and some of those are underestimated. Beyond that, we also want to show investors what our strategy is and what our plans are for the long term. We've been investing in new platforms, new technologies, which we believe will shape the future of medicine in cancer, immune diseases, and beyond. For instance, cell therapies, gene therapies, antibody drug conjugates, radio conjugates. Really, this is our goal: show people that we are focused on today, but also tomorrow to 2030 and the long term.
The CEO, we're speaking with Pascal Soriot, the CEO of AstraZeneca. I'm looking at the stock here. AZN is the ticker. It's a big company, $230 billion market cap. The stock is up 6% today on the back of those strong earnings, up 12% year to date. Pascal, I always joke to people and I say, in my next life, I want to come back as a healthcare M&A banker, because it seems like every Monday we come in and pharmaceutical company A is buying pharmaceutical company B or biotechnology company C. How does M&A, growth via acquisition, fit in with your growth strategy vis-a-vis organic growth that comes from your own in-house R&D?
Yeah, thanks, Paul. It's another great question. We identified a number of years ago the technology platforms of the future, as I said a minute ago. So if you look at cell therapy, for instance, we have our own internal efforts, and we've been complementing this with acquisitions or licensing agreements. In particular, we bought a cell therapy company that is bringing us technologies, but also products. And we've been putting all of this together to actually build a portfolio of products in cell therapy, in gene therapy, in antibody drug conjugates, and beyond. So we target small to mid-size bolt-on acquisitions. That's really has been our strategy. So we can integrate them much better, and then we can add value along the way before we launch.
Pascal, what can you tell us about drug prices right now? I mean, this is such a sensitive topic here in the US, especially in an election year, something that's really close to the heart of so many consumers and voters. I mean, can you tell us a little bit about the pricing strategy and, are people able to afford a lot of these medications?
Yeah, it's important, first of all, to remember that in the United States, of course, price is an issue like everywhere in the world, but in the United States, patients have access to innovative medicines that can save their lives much faster than in Europe or in other parts of the world. Innovation is rewarded and access is much faster. Now, price is definitely a consideration, of course. The IRA, of course, has some challenges and some issues we are trying to work to address, but there's also a big benefit for patients, which is that starting in 2025, there will be a copay cap. Patients will not pay more than $2,000 a year who are on Medicare Part D products. And this year it's $3,500 or $600 as a max. So ultimately, if you're a Medicare patient, you will not pay more than $2,000 a year for your medicines, regardless of how many medicines you have and how much they cost. So that will be really an enormous progress for patients. And of course, some of these rebates or that are discounts that are required to compensate for this, we will be paying. But suddenly we see that as a big improvement for patients and hopefully also an incremental revenue for us because patients will be able to afford their medicines and take them and stay on them longer. So, you know, win-win, really better for patients and hopefully better for the industry as well.
Pascal, I'm looking at the on the Bloomberg terminal, the PGEO function, which shows me kind of your revenue by segment. And I see that oncology is your biggest revenue line there, about 37% of total revenue. What are the opportunities there in your oncology business? I know it's a competitive business, but what do you have in the pipeline? What do you have to bring to market? How do you think about that business?
Yeah, our oncology portfolio of products grew by 26% in the first quarter to $5 billion in the quarter. So we are on a very strong trajectory driven by a number of products that we have in the portfolio for lung cancer, breast cancer, prostate cancer, ovarian cancer, and there's more to come. And the future of oncology really is about combination therapy, combination of antibody-drug conjugates, as I said before, those products that target the tumor cells and deliver a toxin at the site of the tumor cell and essentially kill the tumor cells without affecting the healthy cells around, and combining this with immuno-oncology products, and then in the long run, adding cell therapy to this. So there's an enormous amount of innovation that's going on in cancer. The biology of cancer is being improved very rapidly, and as a result, new medicines are coming up. There are still cancers, unfortunately, that are difficult to treat. But one of the other aspects of cancer that is very important is diagnosing patients early so you can intercept the disease early. If you look at breast cancer, mammographies have really helped diagnose breast cancer very early, and the survival rate at 5 years is 99% when patients are diagnosed early. Lung cancer is the opposite, diagnosed too late. So there are now technologies that will enable to patients and doctors to diagnose cancer very early and treat it early. So the combination of this plus new treatments gives us hope that there is a possibility that in the near future we could actually turn cancer, cure cancer, or turn it to a chronic condition that people can live with.
Pascal, 30 seconds left here. One of our readers writes in and says, on your May 21st Investor Day, are you going to give a big sales target for 2030?
I think I will have to invite people to our meeting in Cambridge in the UK. We've even, you know, offered to offer them a lunch. So I won't disclose that today, but we certainly will show people our strategy and why we believe we can be a growth company and what will be the growth drivers. But I can't say today whether we will be disclosing a target at that point.
All right, Pascal, thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate you sparing a few minutes of your time today. Pascal Soriot, he's the CEO of AstraZeneca, joining us from London via Zoom. The company reported strong numbers this morning.
This is the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live each weekday, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern, on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.